Question for you. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you were on the outside looking in? Kind of feel like you're in a crowd of people and you kind of feel alone. I ever hear that every now and then? You could be like in the biggest city in the world but feel alone in it, you know? Or you're on the outside looking in, and the group you're looking in on is the ones that have like all the talents, all the gifts, all the abilities that you wished you had. You ever found yourself there? And the more you're looking at that, and the more you're kind of feeling like, oh, I wished. They're the privileged group, and I'm not. Or maybe it's a family situation. Maybe it's, they have such a great supportive family. I wished I had that. Or, man, it's so neat to see like a dad spend that kind of time. I wish my dad did, you know. Or maybe it's just financially, like, we're barely making it, but I'm in the company of other people, and I'm looking in on their circle, and wow, they are fine and completely stable. And the more you look in, when you're on the outside looking in sometimes, the more you start to feel powerless, helpless, insecure, insignificant sometimes. Have you ever been in a situation where you were on the inside looking out, maybe? Or maybe that was you. Where everything about your health was great. You're the one in the great marriage. Or you're the one that had the great supportive family. Or you had the great job. And you saw people looking in your life a little bit, and you kind of wondered, what were they thinking? And kind of, maybe sometimes you almost didn't want to share about the next blessing God hit you with, like the 14th one that week, because you're like, what if they didn't get any blessing this week? Now all of a sudden you're like, maybe I shouldn't share anything. Being in the inside, looking out, or being on the outside, looking in, sometimes can put you in a pretty crazy spot. So which leads us this morning, what I'd like to walk us through together is the story of Ruth. I don't know if you've ever been or in that story or have read that story. But if you would, with me this morning, turn in your Bibles to the book of Ruth. And I want to just start, and we're going to kind of walk through this, different passages I'm going to read, different passages I'm going to try to skip over and summarize. It's a four-chapter book. And it starts with this sentence. During the time the judges ruled, is the story of Ruth. During the time the judges ruled. It's a pretty big sentence, because if anybody's familiar with the time of the judges, it was a really dark, dark time for this nation of Israel. And it was in this nation during that time, during the time the judges ruled, there's this deep cycle going on, moral decline, to the point where they were sinning big time as a nation, which would in turn lead it that God would work it out, that another nation would rise up, defeat them, and oppress them. So all of a sudden this nation, not only are they declining morally, doing things they shouldn't, not worshiping Yahweh, now all of a sudden they've got another nation that's subjugating them to the point that they start shooting their flares off to God in prayer. God, help us, this is horrible. They start crying out to God in distress, and then lo and behold, the reason for the name Judges isn't Judge Judy necessarily, but God would raise up a deliverer to rescue him. And the deliverer was a judge. And maybe the thought would be, whoa, we just went through this crazy cycle, sin, oppression, distress, now deliverance. Hey, hopefully we're good now. We won't go back down old paths and old ways, right? And lo and behold, there'd maybe be some years of prosperity and good things and peace, and they were following God, and it would just cycle down again. And what happened, what you get in the book of Judges, is that cycle repeating itself over and over and over and over and over and over. And as it repeats, it doesn't just repeat, it gets worse and worse and worse. Until you end Judges with a story, a disturbing, disturbing story of a Levite man who sends his concubine out, sends her out to be raped throughout the night by the townspeople. He could have done something about it, but doesn't. Sends her out. Throughout the night, that goes down to the point that it's the following morning, the sun comes up, and she crawls to the door with her hand on the flesh threshold and falls over dead. And he opens the door, and the first words out of his mouth is, "Get up. Let's go." Nothing. Which enrages him. He gets real upset because his property was destroyed. Oh, that's some pretty darkness. When all of a sudden people aren't people anymore. And a lot of times you know how a nation's doing morally in the way it treats those that are weak. Or those, not maybe necessarily weak, but maybe those that don't have all the privileges. Or those that have power over. Because in that day, how it ended up working, it was just, it was a type of society that was patrilineal and patriarchal. Like what? Like it was a male-dominated society kind of thing. If you were a woman in those times and you had no man connected to your life, like if you didn't have a husband, you didn't have a father, you didn't have sons, that would be an example of an individual who was utterly destitute. You needed that man in your life to be able to transact within society, to be able to buy anything, purchase anything, to have any kind of status, any kind of role, to be able to do anything, to operate, to function, to have any kind of safety whatsoever, because there's not like police officers where you call 911. None of that. And you would be utterly destitute. And the whole society was set up that the person that held the power was men over the women. And so that's how those with power treated those without power. That's how dark it got. And then you have the story of Ruth in the midst of that. Whoa, like how dark and depressing can this become? And Ruth is actually not a story about a nation and kings and judges. It's actually a story about an individual picturing light in the midst of intense, intense darkness. And one might think, hey, if I were to ask you, or I don't know how much time you spent in Ruth, maybe some of you here, I've never even heard of that book. Or maybe, man, I've been through that book a lot. I have a lot of experience reading that book. If I asked you, like, who would be the main character in the story of Ruth? And maybe the thought will be, well, Ruth, of course. It's named after her, right? But what if it wasn't? What if she wasn't the main character? Well, who else is in the book? Naomi's in the book. That's her mother-in-law. And I would submit to you this morning that she's even more of a main character than Ruth just because of this. She begins the book and she ends the book. She begins the book with a statement that the rest of the book responds to. But what if she wasn't the main character? Well, maybe it's Boaz. He's the guy in the book. Kind of comes in as a rescuer. Maybe he's the main character, right? What if he's not? But what if this whole story of Ruth was God using central characters to reveal his heart? And it was actually him as the main character in the story. What if? So here we go. Let's start the story. So here it is. You have this woman, and as I told you before, starting the book is a woman named Naomi. She starts the book. And she's married to a guy, and his name's Elimelech. And here's the thing. She's tremendously privileged because she has a man in her life. Woo! And she also has even more privilege yet. She has two sons. Two sons. Amazing. Privileged. Blessed. Security. And all of a sudden, their family gets hit with a massive crisis. No food. Like, no food. Famine. So it's like, oh, what do you do in the midst of a famine? And it's like you start checking your phone. Where's their food? Moab has got food going on. Bethlehem's out of food. That's where they're from. Bethlehem, that's kind of a funny town. Familiar one, you know. So here they are in Bethlehem. There's no food. We got to leave town. We got to go to another town, another nation altogether. So they find themselves in Moab where there's food. And while in Moab, the two sons meet two girls and get married. Woo! Awesome. They're married now. And then another crisis hits. Naomi's husband dies. Oh. But she's not destitute, though. At least that, right? She at least has men in her life. But then the story goes worse, and both of her sons die. Oh, no. Now she's this widow, super vulnerable, in a foreign country. And essentially she tells her two daughters, hey, look, you don't have to stay with me. It would appear as though there's food back in Bethlehem, where I'm from, and I'm going to go back there, but you don't have to stay with me. Y'all can just stay. Go back to your dad's homes, and maybe you'll find comfort within another husband. One of the daughter-in-laws leave, tears. The other one doesn't, Ruth. And if we could pick up in the story, chapter 1 of Ruth, verse 11. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons? This is kind of odd, right? Am I going to have any more sons? Who could become your husband? Like, whoa. Like, are you just kidding? Or are you for real right there? You would actually wait for this little child that I'm old enough to be their parent, raised up, and then I would marry them? Like, exactly. That's how they did it back then. The goal would be to stay within the family kind of deal. And she's like, look, I'm too old. Even if I had a husband tonight, would you wait for me to have a son that grew up? Go to your own home and return home, verse 12, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband, and even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. You see what Naomi just said right there? The Lord has made my life bitter. So here's my question. Is that really what God's in the business of doing? Making people's lives empty? Hence, the rest of this book responding to that statement. Is he really about making my life empty? So that's what she tells him. That's where Naomi is right now. She's in this place of deep grieving to the point she's like, look, you guys just go home. The Lord's made my life empty, bitter. So at this, they wept again, and then Orpah, who was one of the daughter-in-laws, kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth, on the other hand, and this was Ruth's claim to fame. This is huge. I mean, Ruth is widowed too. Ruth's claim to fame, this is huge. Ruth clung to her mother-in-law. And in verse 15, look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. Verse 16, but Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. And when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So that's kind of Ruth's claim to fame, right? I mean, obviously, one key characteristic about Ruth is, wow, that was a move of faith, right? faithfulness to Yahweh. She's willing to give up and be vulnerable right alongside of Naomi when, hey, this is destitute to not have a man in your life. And she's willing to do that and then go to a foreign country back with her mother-in-law? Whoa! That is a big deal. But what if there's something even more beyond the faith of Ruth that this story is about? While on one hand, yes, there is tremendous faith out of that central character, but what if there's something more on the pages to come up and unearth and surface? So, verse 19, so the two women went on until they came back home to that familiar town, Bethlehem. And when they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Is this really Naomi? Naomi that used to live here, then moved away and came back? Is that her? No way! Woo! Family reunion! You know what I'm saying? And, you know, you're excited too, right, Naomi? Then all of a sudden they get this response like, oh. And she says, don't call me Naomi. She told them, call me Mara. What? Like, I got two names too, just so you know. It's really funny. Like, Chester's not even my real name. Real name is Stephen. How do you get Stephen out of Chester? Long story. Ask Pastor Timothy. It'd be a great conversation. So, don't call me Naomi because that means sweet. There's nothing in my life that's sweet right now. Rather, why don't you call me what would appropriately fit my life? Call me bitter. Mara. Let's do that. Let's make that my new name. Call me Mara, bitter. Oh, bitter? Why you want to be called bitter? Because, verse 20 again, the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full. Now here's the claim to fame. Here it is, right here. The whole book responding to this. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. So Naomi's like, look, don't call me Naomi. Don't call me sweet, call me Mara. And here's why. Because God, for whatever reason, treated me differently, and he's in the business of making my life empty. I went away from Bethlehem full, and now I'm back empty because the Almighty's hand has been against me. Here's the thing I kind of wonder. Is God just going to like let it sit like that? Or is this an opportunity for God to respond through some unique circumstances and some unique characters? So, here they are. This is really, really significant because it's when the barley harvest is beginning, and barley harvest is a big deal. Like, they have harvest. They've got food coming in. So it's almost like, let's celebrate whenever there's harvest, right? I mean, if it was like, if we were to go to Krispy Kreme's kind of deal and they were all coming off hot, let's just drop what we're doing and go there because the hot sign's on. Like, my kids seem to see that hot sign even before I do. They've been trained to see if the hot sign's on. You know, they even give you a free one. It's so celebratory. You know what I mean? And it's like, woo, it's hot right now. Let's stop, you know? And it's the barley harvest. Let's have some festivities. It's a great time. And so Ruth is the younger daughter-in-law, and Naomi is the older one. And there was a law, if you guys are familiar with this or not, that was supposed to be in effect in the nation of Israel at the time. And here's how the law went. If you happen to be a farmer, and you had land, and you raised crops, maybe you guys are familiar with this, what you would specifically do is only go over that field one time. Like nowadays, we have a combine that can go over top of a field one time, and that field is as flat as can be. Everything's gone. But then, when you go over it one time, there's stuff still standing in the field. And specifically, Yahweh was like, do not go over that field again. And then when you do reap your harvest in, don't go to the very edges. leave it stand. Like, who would do that? That's money in the field. Who would do that? And Yahweh's like, I want you to do that because I would do that. And the reason I want you to leave that standing is if there's anyone in that lives in your town that's destitute, that they could go in that field and feed their starving households. And here's the thing. Ruth and Naomi are like, maybe someone will honor that law and let Ruth go into their field and get whatever food she can find after the harvesters have gone through it once. But you know, that's kind of crazy to do that, right? Imagine this woman all by herself going out into the field to glean, especially during the time the judges ruled. That's crazy. Don't go outside. Let's pick up at chapter 2. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side. There happened to be a relative that lived there. Well, that's great. Who is it? I'm not sure. From the clan of Elimelech. That was her husband's name, Elimelech. A man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. Maybe somebody will let me in their field just pick what's left. Naomi said to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. And as it turned out, she found herself, just happened to be, yes, you know, probably coincidence, right? Because we all believe in coincidence. No. Rather divine appointment kind of stuff, right? It just turns out, it just happens to be the field she lands in is this guy Boaz. It's kind of a relative, but here's the thing, we don't know. Well, what's he going to do? Is he like the rest of the culture that he grew up in? We heard about the culture that they've been growing up in. It's not been very good. Darkness. What's this guy like? She finds herself in his field, of all fields. And as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. And just then, Boaz arrived. Okay, the guy, here's the thing to think about right now. The guy with all the power who owns the field just showed up, and his workers have been working in it. And then there's some random girl in there. Who's she? Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. And what's his relationship with his workers like? And look, listen to what it's like. The Lord be with you, they say. Huh. That's a little different. Probably wouldn't hear that in typical fields in that day and that time. You know, the guy that has all the power, the owner, the landowner, the boss. I mean, how's the boss typically talked about? The Lord be with you, they say to him. And he responds back, the Lord bless you. Or he says to them, the Lord be with you. They respond back, the Lord bless you. In verse 5, Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, whose young woman is that? Who's that? You know, who's that? Why is she in here? And the foreman replied, she's the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. And she went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. Here's the thing I just want you to imagine. Just pretend, just for a minute, just pretend that you're Ruth and you are in this field and you've been working just hoping that you have favor from whoever owns this field. And all of a sudden, the guy with all the power shows up. He owns this field, and he connects his eyes with yours, and he starts to make his way to you during the time the judges ruled. What might be going through your mind? I don't know what to expect right now. Like, anything can happen, and nothing will be done about it. And all of a sudden, he makes his way over to her. And I just submit this to you this morning. It is telling. It is intense. The very first words out of his mouth could have been any first words were these. Verse 8. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter." Whoa. Whose field am I in? Something's different about this field. "My daughter." That's how he responds to her. "Listen to me," he says. "Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servants' girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. Watch this." He had to specifically say this. "I've told the men not to touch you." I had to specifically say that. Why? Because during the time the judges ruled. "And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars." And here's how it should be. This is how it should probably read. Ready? "Whenever you're thirsty, go get a drink." Problem is, they don't have drinking fountains. They don't have like a cup of water, that kind of thing. Here's how it should have gone. "Go and get a drink from the water jar you'll be filling for all the men." And that would mean walk down these steps, fill up a water jar that's really heavy, and climb them steps multiple times. The women did that. But it doesn't read that way. He says, "When you're thirsty, go get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." In this field, we do it a little different. Every other field, women fill all that. Not here. The men fill it. That's crazy. I'd imagine people, "What? You have your men doing that? Why ain't the women doing that?" No, we do it different. The men fill the water jars. "Hey, Ruth, you're in our field working. If you're thirsty at any point, you just go get you a drink." And it was costly to get a drink. Someone had to pay to go get that water out of there. "And you go get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." Whose land am I on right now? This is crazy. It's kind of odd, you know? It's kind of really odd, you know? Because it almost seems like she came into his field empty. But she's not all that empty right now, is she? So, look here. "So at this, she bowed down with her face to the ground, and she even exclaimed, 'Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?' And Boaz replied, 'I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and your mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. And may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge.'" She then says, "May I continue," verse 13, "'to find favor in your eyes, my Lord,' she said. 'You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I don't even have the status or the standing of one of your servant girls.'" That's crazy you would treat me this way in your field. "And at mealtime," Boaz said to her, "'Come over here.'" Now all of a sudden it's lunch, right? Mealtime. "'Hey, Ruth, come on over a minute. Have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar.'" Hey, wait. I thought the rule was you just leave grain standing. No one said meal prep. No one said, like, make sandwiches and you can have sandwiches. Nothing like that. Wait a second. There's something about this guy in this field that he even tells her, "Come in and eat with us." What? That's almost beyond what the law of Israel was meant to look like. Eat with them? And then it goes further. "And she ate all she wanted." It was like buffet style, probably. You know what I mean? Like endless stack of pancakes, you know, but not pancakes, you know. "She ate all she wanted and had some left over. And as she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to the men." And here, I'm going to stop right here. "He comes into his field empty and leaves full." So full. She has a to-go box. That's pretty odd, isn't it? Especially Naomi saying, God's in the business of making people's lives empty. Sends out her daughter-in-law, Ruth, and she has this whole experience of coming into this guy's field empty-handed and leaving full with a to-go box. What? And so then, to the point, Boaz still isn't done.
gives these, kind of says these things in verse 15. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to the men. Even if she gathers among the sheaves, a place she's not technically supposed to go, even if she goes in there, don't embarrass her. Don't be like, what are you doing in there? You're not supposed to be in there. Don't do that. Don't even go there. Don't even go there. It's almost like he's concerned emotionally for her. Don't embarrass her. Rather, do this. Pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up. If she's in a place where there isn't any, just throw some down. Just throw some down so you can pick that up. And don't rebuke her. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening, and then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah, and she carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she gathered, and Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over, and after she had eaten enough. And her mother-in-law asked her, where did you glean today? I mean, for real? Where were you? This is nuts. How in the world do you have that much and a to-go box? Were you like Logan's or Ruth also brought out verse and gave her what she had left over, and she had had enough. And her mother-in-law, verse 19 again, says, where did you glean today? Where do you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. And the name of the man I work with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. Whoa. What is that even? Here's the thing. Here's the whoa part. As far as I understand this, and this is kind of what I'd heard, that the exact middle verse of the Hebrew text is that kinsman redeemer verse. The fulcrum that this whole book sits on. The kinsman redeemer? Who is this? What is the kinsman redeemer? Here's the best attempt that I could try to share with you what a kinsman redeemer is. Apparently, back in that time, there was this law. I think in Deuteronomy 25, this may surface. This Levirate law. And here's how it went. Back then, and in those times, if you, it was all extended family living. It wasn't like you have today. You get married, you go live in this apartment. You get married, you go buy this house, and everybody kind of lives separate. It was extended family. And here's how it worked. It was also like, it was a kind of a man-dominated society. So here's how it worked. You were born in your family, and you were a girl. Woo! I'm with my mom. I'm doing all kinds of great stuff. But then you get married. Guess what? You don't get to live there anymore. Everything you knew, you're not in that anymore. You leave that home, and you go, and you live with your husband's home. And they called it a batab, your husband's home. And in your husband's home was his dad and grandfather and brothers and their wives and everybody. You almost like attach a piece to the house where you live. And all the women would move into their husband's homes. That's just kind of how it worked. Now, remember what I told you. Imagine if your husband died and you had no sons. That would be an example of someone that's utterly destitute. Utterly destitute, because the woman had no way of like buying things, selling things, operating, no way, protection, any of that stuff. So there's this law that was made, the Levirate law, and here's kind of how it worked. If for some reason you found yourself a widow with no sons, this is kind of crazy. The closest male relative would marry you. Even if he may already be married, he would marry you. And also what would happen is this, all the property that you owned with your husband, he would absolve all that debt. He would take all that on. And then once he married you and you had a son, the very first son that you had wouldn't be his. It would be his dead brother's son, technically. And all that property property that you absolved, he absolved, would be given in inheritance to that firstborn son to maintain the name of the dead with its property. So this kinsman redeemer was meant to come alongside this widowed woman with no man in her life and absolve the debts, marry her, provide security for her, have a son with her, and her firstborn son would be her dead husband's son. And the name would still remain. And it wouldn't be that the name just, the husband's name was just gone. And she would be provided for. And what Naomi is saying right here about Boaz is, hey, Ruth, listen, this is crazy. He's a close relative of ours. He's a kinsman redeemer. He can save our lives from utter destitution. He can save our lives from the pit. So how the story ends up going is, Ruth's like, here's what you got to do. Naomi's like, here's what you got to do, Ruth. Look, you need to go get your best clothes on. You need to bathe. You need to, like, perfume yourself. And here's what you got to do. You got to go down to the threshing floor when they bring in the harvest. Go down to the threshing floor where Boaz will be. Wait till everybody goes to sleep. And then go lay down by his feet. What? Okay. So she goes and she does this. Everybody goes to sleep. She goes and lays down by his feet. Covers himself with a corner of something, and all of a sudden he's startled in the middle of the night, like, whoa, why is there a girl here? There shouldn't be a girl here. And he's like, and she's like, look, will you redeem me, essentially? I don't know, is this a roundabout way of saying, will you marry me? You know what I'm saying? And Boaz is like, whoa, I mean, that's pretty amazing that you would want me to. You could have gone after anybody, and look, you know what? I will redeem you, but here's a problem. He's not the closest relative. The closest male relative has the right to redeem her and marry her and take on the property. And the big question is, will that closest relative want to do that? You know what the problem is? We don't even know who he is. Who is that guy? You can't be doing that with Ruth. We don't even know him. We need to get to know him. Because who could he be? I mean, it's during the time the judges ruled. It could be anybody. So Boaz is like, look, this is what we got to do. I got to go to the town square and settle this matter to see if this closer relative wants to redeem you and be your kinsman redeemer. And if he does, he's got the right to do it, and I can't. But if not, I'll do it. But here, look, I noticed you didn't come in with anything. You came empty. Put your shawl down. Let me fill it up with grain. Take that back to your mom. Every time Ruth comes to this guy, she comes empty and leaves full. Remember Naomi? Man, God, his hand is against me. He's in the business of making people's lives empty. Funny, all this is happening, right? So she goes home and tells her mom, and her mom's like, whoa, all that food again? And she tells her mom what happens, and her mom's like, man, he'll take care of this, don't you worry. So all of a sudden, Boaz goes to the town square where all the leaders, I guess the men, gather, and he's like, look, and he finds the closer relative, and he's like, look, hey, Naomi, Ruth, the Moabites, the property of Elimelech needs to be redeemed. Do you want to take that? Yes, he says, I'll redeem it. Oh, we wanted it to be Boaz. But then Boaz adds, look, if you take on the property, here's what you also take on. You take on the dead man's widow as well. To the point that that closer relative says, man, that's too costly for me. I don't want it. And Boaz says, well, I'm the next in line, so I have the right to redeem it. And then the closer relative says, then you redeem it. And they make the transaction, and then it happens. And then he marries Ruth. Woo! Huge blessing, but you see, it was costly for the kinsman redeemer because the kinsman redeemer had to absolve all the debts of the property. And it's not like you get to keep them. All of that would go to the firstborn son that would technically not be his, even though it was. But here's the other thing that he acquires. He acquires Naomi, the mother-in-law, moves in. Remember how I said it started with Naomi and it ends with Naomi? Look here. In chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And the women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer." Look, do you see it? It began with Naomi. It ends with Naomi. Wait, this was Ruth's baby. Why aren't they saying, "Ruth, you're amazing"? No, it's Naomi. Naomi's hit with this. Judges ended in death, 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 death. But Ruth, an individual story of light in the midst of that time, ends with the birth of a baby. Life. Here Naomi sits, who had said, "The Lord Almighty has made my life empty. I've come, left full, and now I'm back empty." And here she sits with a grandson on her lap. How is that, Naomi? God is not in the business of making your life empty. He just filled you. You have a son. You are not destitute anymore. In a culture that was all about the men dominating and the men's just how it worked, then if you didn't have a man in your life, you would be considered utterly destitute. But you know what the problem is, though? It'd be funny if the book ended there. Just ended, woo, happily ever after, time to go home. Problem is it doesn't. There's just a little bit more. And here's where I submit to you all that what if the main character in this story was not Naomi? What if it wasn't Ruth? What if it wasn't Boaz? What if they were all key central characters? It was really important they were there. But there was a main character the whole time at play. And that main character wanted to reveal his heart to us. And this is how the book ends. Verse 16. Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. That's kind of funny. We're going to run with a family tree right now. That's cool to know who all the kids were. But what if that's not the point? Well, you look. And Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Abinadab, and Abinadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz. Okay, we got Boaz now. There's this family tree. That's where Boaz fell. And then Boaz became the father of Obed, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David. What if this kinsman redeeming love of God is shown in Boaz, of how God is about the destitute, the poor, the widow, the fatherless? And he really is. And in the midst of a culture where no one is, he is. And there's a key character, Boaz, that really, really reflects the heart of the Father. And what Boaz does on a personal level ends with what David will do on a national level, and whose name is not mentioned, implicit to the whole book. Coming down that line is what Jesus will do on an international level of being the kinsman redeemer in our lives to make our lives full and not empty. I've come that you may have life and have it more abundantly. This story is about the heart of God. This is the kind of heart the Father has for you. And the big question is, have we experienced the kinsman redeeming love of the Father? Are we living in it? The kinsman redeeming love of the Father, do we know what he's rescued us from and the kind of life he wants to give us, the fullness of life he wants to bring, where it what he wants to do is place he himself, his spirit, in us. Huge. Not only are we forgiven, not only are we in the kingdom, not only are we fully righteous, but we're his sons and daughters with his presence dwelling us. So here, one, have we experience and do we live in the kinsman redeeming love of God? But you know the call in every one of our lives if that is the case.
is how is it that we're exhibiting the kinsman redeeming love of God out of our life? Let's go back to where we started. Power. Did you know that everybody in the room here has power? All of us do. We all have power. We all have a place of prestige. We all have a place of gifts that someone is looking into our lives saying, whoa, they're every one of us, someone is looking in our lives. They're looking in. And here's the question. How is it that we deal with that power? When we have power over others, what do we do with it? Hey, maybe you get to be the supervisor. Or you're in a relationship with a girl. Or you are the one that is not the one on the bench. You're actually the star athlete kind of guy. Or you're the one that, like, the job is soaring. Like, financially, we're doing good. I mean, just things are good. And you have all this power God's given. How will you use it? Will you use it to just step on and crush and take and get more? Or will we use it to lift up and build up and breathe life into other people as the heart of God does? So here's the thing. I'm gonna throw this one out. Ready? This is gonna be something random. Right, here we go. As we end. Sex trafficking, slave trade. Huge epidemic on the planet. None of us would want to contribute to that in any way, right? Maybe we don't think about it too much, but you know, we would really, really, really think about it if it was one of our daughters that got pulled in on that, right? Yet, do we contribute to it? Like looking lustfully at another? Have we in some way just contributed to the hell on earth? When, I've heard it said like this, when you look at lust on another person, a she or a he become a that. A bearer of the divine spark becomes a that. And whenever that's going on, they become a that. So what about that free porn link that didn't seem to cost? Was it free? I've heard this said, that the porn industry is over $1 billion industry. That it's more than the combined baseball, football, and basketball, pro basketball revenue combined. The amount spent on porn was more than the United States spent on foreign aid. So, what do we do with that? And so what supposedly may be this free thing actually might be contributing, and what I may be seeing is people being held against their will, all this kind of stuff, and I've just contributed, and actually there was a cost and there was a price. But what are we going to be? What is it going to be? The trajectory of my life, will it become? I want to use the power that I have to lift up and build up instead of take and get. What will my life become? What will the trajectory of my life become? Will it be to see the kingdom of hell ushered through my life even more the way it was happening during the time the judges ruled when everybody did as they saw fit? Or will it be that no more will I go down that path? Then I want to see the kingdom of heaven, the kinsman redeeming love of God ushered through my life as his spirit dwells in me and can empower me and all of us to do that. And lay down some of these things that maybe taking a she or he and making them a that. So, to end, that was one example. To raid into our lives, what would you say is a place of power that God has privileged you with? God's given you power. Maybe it's, I think this is power, okay? Just so you know, I'm going to throw this out there. I think that a person that has power is a person that has time,
extra time and resources. And oftentimes, you see that with a person, not everyone, that can be of retirement age. What a blessing you could breathe your resources onto the life of another that would be real characteristic of them, no time, no resources. And who do I think in that category? Moms. You know what I'm saying? And how kinsman redeeming love could flow out of your life. And I'll just tell you this. There is one example of this at the mission. There is a woman there that's the nurse that's got to be the 80s plus pushing 90 that like gives her time hard and meets with the men. And I've had conversations with her. I'm like, whoa, how come you're not like in a condo on the beach? And she's like, man, I can run with that like a month, but then I'm like, I got to be done with that. And I just almost wonder that for some, the time they've hit retirement age, is that the place that God's like, I want to use you in a huge way. I freed you up from some stuff. Let's go. Let's go now. Let's breathe life into people. Let's see the kinsman redeeming love of God come out of your life. So the question then is this. Where is it? Maybe you're the star athlete. Would you be willing to associate with a person on the bench? And maybe we're not even talking sports. Let me pray, and we'll close. Dear God, I thank you for today, Lord. I thank you for this chance that we could be here together, Lord. I thank you for who you are, God. I thank you for the kinsman redeeming love, Lord, that you have shown off. God, like we are undeserving, God, we are unable to save ourselves, but God, you went this great length to rescue us, Lord, where you pictured what redeemer means in the story of Boaz and Ruth. You gave us an illustration. If we ever wondered, like, what does redeemer mean? There it is, right there. That's what it looks like, and Boaz did it, and that's your heart, God, and that's what you want us to experience in you, this kinsman redeeming love, where you come and make our lives full. And God, I just pray that if it's been characteristic of our lives, Lord, that we would get off that trajectory, Lord, if it's been characteristic that we've been about taking and getting. But God, that we would be willing to use the power and the privilege and the blessings you give us to lift up and build up others. And that in so doing, God, we could see your kingdom ushered through as the kinsman redeeming love pours out of our lives by the power of your Spirit. Help us, God, to live for your glory. For you, God, are amazing that you would go this great of a length. Thank you for the story of Ruth and exposing your heart all over the pages, God. And help us, God. I just pray that by the power of your Spirit, you would stir within us deep affections for you, that the affections of our heart would be you. Help us, God. We love you and we praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.
From Philippians chapter 4, And my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. To our God and Father be glory forever and ever. Amen. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit.